Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experience of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything.
Hello, here we are again. Although we could, in theory, as long as nothing's changed, meet this week, we actually haven't because we're recording it last week. So
we tend to record two or three at a time because then we get into a really good chat level,
yeah,
which is great. So
it is great.
We still are not eating cake. We are not offending you by eating cake in your face and not offering you any, which we will be doing at some point.
We will be doing, yes.
And but at another time when it's all clear, we will be offering workshops with cake.
Woohoo! Yes. So today I decided that rather than espousing once again my favourite tarot decks or oracle decks or whatever, I would do the thing far more common amongst our ancestors and amongst our Celtic ancestors, which is to simply use the natural world as an omen.
Mm.
And so I went to my window, I looked outside, and there I saw the beautiful, beautiful red blossoms of my quince tree. And was immediately filled with the kind of the sense of the joy yes. of the unfurling and the bursting and the thrusting forth of spring. And yeah, I mean, how I managed to look at the quince rather than the magnolia, which is even closer, but I guess so. That the omen, thank you so much. Sorry, I've just been delivered a cup of tea. Sorry, Maggie and everyone. Sorry. How rude.
At least he's including cake.
I know, yes, he wouldn't. He doesn't understand cake. Anyway, we digress.
Not the magnolia.
Not the magnolia. And what's important about an omen, and I do persist in calling it an omen, and after you asked me the other day, why is it an omen and not a sign?
Mm.
I really thought about that. And why is it an omen, not a sign?
Mm.
And for me, it's because an omen isn't really an everyday word.
Yes.
And an omen is clearly divination. Now, the word divination means something like asking counsel with the gods or seeking counsel with the gods, something like that. And I think an omen carries the weight of that, even though ominous, which clearly comes from it, definitely means a bad omen.
Mm.
The word itself, omen itself, is actually a neutral word for a prophetic sign. Yeah. But to me, the word sign doesn't carry any of the overtones of being in connection with the divine and with spirit and, you know, with the gods.
Which takes us exactly back to what we were talking about before, which is the Gabor Maté book is great because it's got signs in it, but it hasn't got omens.
Right, fair. Anyway.
It's not spiritual, but it gets a similar message.
Yeah.
But I absolutely agree with you. An omen is something which quite frequently brings awe.
Yes. Yeah.
And I mean awe as in the... Oh,
yeah, the understanding
yes.
that something is being transmitted, yes. perhaps.
Yes.
So what I wanted to say about the magnolia as an omen, if you like, or the quince flowers as an omen, is that it doesn't need to have an intrinsic meaning of its own. And indeed, in those... Well, especially the magnolia, you know, our ancient druidic ancestors or the, you know, the people we call the Celts or in this particular region, the Dumnonii, you know, the tribal peoples who lived here in the ancient times, almost certainly, I would suggest, didn't have a magnolia tree to look at. But they might well. I don't know where magnolia come from, but I bet it ain't here.
Mm.
And I doubt they've been here since Victorians or someone imported them.
Yeah.
But some other flowering tree might very well have delivered the very same message to my ancestors of place 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 20, 30, 40,000 years ago.
Yeah.
Because it might have said, be full of joy, be full of the gladness of spring, which is what these flowers said to me this morning. Celebrate the bursting forth of life, of a new year, of... not a new year, a new season, a new growth, new reasons to be utterly jubilant because it's warming up and everything's growing and there's going to be food on your table and scent in the air and all the rest of it. And just as a totally random aside, did you know you can eat the flowers of the magnolia?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, it's very exciting. Must find out if you can eat the flowers of the quince. Although also it's wise to point out that if you eat the flowers, you won't be getting any fruit. Which is, there's always a bit of a quarrel in our house about the flowers / fruit of the elder.
Yes.
Because I love elderflower champagne.
You do.
And Fergus loves elderberry wine.
But we've worked it out because I make the champagne. Yes. He makes the berry and we swap a few bottles. Yes. It works very nicely. We were friends, oh God, that was a challenge. But no, yes, elderflower champagne is just... But you're right.
Oh, it's a business.
It's got to be... Honourable harvest with the elderflowers.
It's got to be honourable harvest.
Huge.
But yeah, back to the omens. The point is that between the omen and the omen reader is a personal relationship.
Yes.
And a relationship of this moment.
Yes.
And so last week, the magnolia or the quince might have meant something completely different to me.
Mm.
And that doesn't mean that either of those things is wrong. What it means is that the message is of the moment.
Yes.
And that when we ask the spirits, they speak to us of here and now and of our authentic being in this moment.
Mm.
And so, you know, if I was in the place of, for example, the card I pulled the last time we spoke for vulnerability, maybe the beautiful red of the quince would have made me think of, you know, blood and mournfulness, or taking me back to our conversation around whether menstrual blood is a lifeblood or a death blood or whatever.
Yeah.
But it didn't. Today, in this moment, at this particular time, with the sun beaming down on the petals and all the rest of it, it was totally, it was like it shouted the word rejoice to me.
Yeah. I've got a parallel story, I think, hopefully, it illustrates that. With last year was the primrose year for me.
Mm.
Primroses were everywhere. And when I was a little girl, I was called Prim.
Wow. Why?
Because I was Prim, presumably. Oh, okay. But people used to mistake it for Primrose.
Right.
So people used to think I was called Primrose. So Primroses to me, last year, it just seemed to be the year for Primroses. They were absolutely everywhere. And I thought they were lovely. I took photographs of them. And they had, to me, they meant a kind of innocence.
Mm-hmm.
And last year I was hunting for wood anemones. Because I'd seen them the year before and I thought I'd never seen them before that I knew of.
Mm.
So I was hunting for them, hunting for the hidden.
Mm.
Hunting for the new, hunting for the hidden. And this year I thought, oh, I better start looking for wood anemones. And I went for a walk and there was one right in front of me. And the message was, you don't need to hunt for the hidden anymore. This year for me, it's the celandines.
Mm, aren't they amazing?
Aren't they? Yeah. So basically this year, it was last year you're hunting for something that's hidden. This year, celebrate shine.
Yeah. Which...
Well, that was that day's message anyway.
Yeah, beautiful.
Yeah.
That really makes me think of my foraging walks. So I do very particular kind of, if you like, omen forage walks at particular times of year and create teas for myself. And I think we've spoken about this before, haven't we, about the crazy way in which evening primrose materialised in great numbers in my garden and then disappeared the year I really needed it. And that... I mean, it is a bit like your story of there wasn't any pussy willow until I discovered I was completely surrounded by it.
Yes. You know,
it's just that when you live in a reciprocal, alive, intelligent, abundant world, which we all do, then it is speaking to us all of the time and it is offering us what we need. If we are in reciprocity with the land, she will offer us, she, he, it will offer us precisely what we need today.
Yes.
Every time.
Yes.
And just enough.
Yes.
And did you know that apparently celandines potentially, along with bluebell bulbs, I think it is, a potentially really exciting cure for cancer?
Really?
Apparently. Yeah, there's some amazing research and they really think they might be onto something. With bluebell and celandine. I don't think together, I think separately.
I don't actually believe there's ever going to be a physical cure for cancer because cancer is a disease of society and emotions and all sorts of things. But if they can go into nature, and if people could know that, that would also help, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, yes, could I be pedantic and say they're looking into wonderful treatments for cancers?
Yeah. Well, and plenty of people will be cured.
Yes, they will. Indeed, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I always say to people, if they talk to me about cancer, you don't come out the same you went in.
I don't think you come out of anything the same you went in.
No,
I
mean, but people do want to.
Of your average Tuesday the same as you went in, do you?
It's just... Okay, fair enough. There I was thinking I'd be really wise, and all I was doing was a very basic platitude. Oh, God, sorry. The day's humiliation. So early. There will be more.
Not in my hand, I hope. I didn't mean it like that.
But you do know what I mean, I hope.
Yeah, I totally know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah. And these diseases are there to point things out for us.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, sorry, I'm still quietly sniggering to myself about it. I love that story so much about, is it your bish that prays for a daily humiliation?
No, it's Richard Rohr. Yes.
Bless him. Yes, and your immediate response to, let there only be one. Fantastic. Yes.
But that's, again, it's this language thing, isn't it? It's the difference between humility and humiliation.
Well, humiliation's what happens to you if you care. You know, if you don't have enough humility.
Yes, actually it is, isn't it?
And you're worried about what other people think
yes.
of you. Which immediately brings me back to the, literally, to me, blood-curdling horror of you saying that today's children are one of the things that they feel is the foundation of their life, is their fucking likes on Facebook.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
I know.
You know, almost all the anecdotal stories I know, and of course, you know, we love a bit of doomsaying, don't we, as a culture. But all the anecdotal stories I know about things that happen on Facebook are the horrendous bullying that takes place on Facebook.
It happens in the comedy forums. Fora.
Does it?
Yeah.
Is that what the plural of a forum is, a fora?
I think so, yeah.
Is it?
Yeah. But we won't worry about it.
No.
We might get into the word like crocus. Crocus is or croci or something like that, which would drive us crazy. Lots of those nice flowers. Yes. Oh, yes, there's an awful lot of bullying and a lot of mansplaining and some womansplaining too and that kind of thing. So, yes, but we comedians are usually folk who do have some ADD, Asperger's, autism aspects to us anyway. So we can fire off in all different directions. That's why we're comedians, because it's much easier, same as with priests, probably much easier to stand up and talk at people than it is to have relationships, isn't it? Especially if you were isolated as a child in any way.
I guess. Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way before. I mean, I do know that amongst the kind of comedian community, it's actually often people who are painfully shy who manage to be incredibly funny and stand up in front of, you know, everyone and make them laugh. But I guess our laughter is a form of absolute approval, isn't it? And when...
Oh, the high after you've got
a really good laugh.
Yes. Or you tell a joke and they laugh and then they give you a round of applause for that joke. And there's such a communication. That is what priesthood actually is about. We have all opened up at this ridiculousness.
Say that again.
We have all opened up at this ridiculousness. We stop taking everything so seriously. We're becoming vulnerable. When we laugh,
right?
We open up. You can get. You can teach people so much more through laughter. There are many other ways. The amount of times I've done comedy about the Bible and people have come up to me after and said, I had no idea. And all I was doing was telling them a joke, but the message has got through as well.
Ha! Secret!
Secret indoctrination of kindness. Secret indoctrination that there's an all-loving beingness.
Wow, yeah. I liked very much, back to bloody old Facebook, but anyway... Somebody put a comment after our recent sharing of the one before last of Vicar and the Witch or something, and you were speaking with somebody about your way into the women in the Bible had been a novel.
Yes.
And, you know I ramble on about the importance of stories in our lives probably every single time we speak.
Good, keep going.
Yeah, just the idea that you could be taught something about the gods and history and all the rest of it through a good novel.
Oh, yes.
I think so many novels are such a missed opportunity for saying something
Really important. Really book. Important. Tales of the Blue Panda, advert. Mine is all about what happens after you die.
Mm. Are you on it, writing another one?
Yeah, kind of. I'm taking care of Mother at the moment, but I've started it, yes. And hopefully I will get a week or two to just sit down and really get into it once I'm there. Not the addiction, but the muse is there, and the muse says, right.
Get on with it.
You have to show up for the muse for a certain amount of time to say, I'm ready and willing to make the commitment. And then the muse turns up, and then at 3 o'clock in the morning you go, oh, what about that? And it becomes alive, you know, when you write a book. It is a living being.
It is. Yeah. Mine's having a sulk with me at the moment. A living being. It's because I get so much is happening in my head and I keep not putting it on the page. I'm not going to the computer at 3 o'clock in the morning.
No.
Because, no, it's too important. I need to sleep.
Yeah.
And actually, frankly, bollocks to that. I should be getting up and putting it down.
Well, yes, in a way, but I do find that when you can't do it at the time you do it is the perfect time. There may still be something else you need to know.
Yeah. Okay, fair.
You know, the book cannot be written till the book is ready to be written.
That is most definitely true.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that brings me actually to a question that I've, in a way, been dying to ask you since the very first moment we started this, which is, you're a very many multiples of published author,
yes,
and I'm an aspiring to be published one day when I've finally written the bloody thing.
Yes.
Author. And yet here we are doing a podcast.
Mm.
So both of us have abandoned the written word in favour of the spoken word.
Mm.
And I've been reading a bunch of absolutely fascinating books. I love them. I love language. I love the idea that language is spells, etc., 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 over the last year. And not years, this year, since the year began. And I probably won't be able to remember the name of half of them, but one of them, well, obviously, much of my fascination with language and spelling as an art of language comes from, well, my education, actually, because I had an amazing English teacher, but perhaps was honed by reading David Abrams' The Spell of the Sensuous.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I read a book called Orality and Literacy by a chap called Walter Ong, which is tragically, I think, out of print now. I got lent a copy because I had one of these kinds of conversations with somebody who happened to have the book. And he in there, and Abrams in his book, and another book, which I, for the life of me, can't remember. Oh, The Tree of Meaning, Robert Brisinghurst, another superb book about the difference between the written word and the spoken word. And what Walter J. Ong's book kind of opened up for me was the idea that in the written word, because you can write something down and then kind of refer to it later, you can become very conceptual.
Mm.
Whereas with the spoken word, you tend to stay with the literal. And so then I was really intrigued, first of all, why aren't we writing letters to each other? Why are we doing a podcast? And then secondly, as Christianity is this children of the book religion, what was it that Christianity wanted to say that was conceptual rather than literal? Why write it down?
Loss of faith.
Explain. Loss of trust.
Well, that's what John Romer wrote in his book Testament, which I read years ago. He had a series on Channel 4. And he said, and I checked this out with my teachers of Greek at uni. I went for a year to study Greek just for the Greek. God knows how everybody did the theology course as well as studying Greek, because I lapped my eyes in just the Greek.
Mm.
But I talked to my two tutors who were both published authors in their own field, and they were saying that all the Gospels are based on what people call a hidden manuscript called Q.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the oral tradition. So right. There was always an oral tradition. And because of the menorah and Kabbalah and certain structures and patterns of the universe, the oral tradition was sufficient and nobody read and read or wrote anyway. But then there became the diaspora, where everybody was kicked out of the Holy Land. And then basically what happened was they got an awful lot of people like me who did it wrong.
Right, fair.
And so they thought, it comes like, for example, I'm not supposed to do any mass between no minister is supposed to do a mass between Maundy Thursday and Easter Sunday. Mm-hmm. I did a requiem on Easter Saturday because nobody told me not to.
Okay.
It seemed to me to be a logical thing to do because it's a Day of the Dead.
But I bet you've read all the books and you still didn't know that. You had to be told.
Yes. Yes, but that's why that's what makes it the living tradition, is that when you talk.
Mm.
So I was talking with the bish this morning about the fact that you shouldn't really have done a mass then. He said, but I didn't tell you, and they don't care. But the reason why you don't do it is because it's good for you to have that time of just contemplation instead. So in talking, you get the, well, as we do, we discuss the language of things.
Mm.
And but for the beginner, you want the book.
Why though? Because to me,
that's a good question. I don't know, but the beginners tend to. People always say, "Is there a book about that?" Whenever I do a workshop, somebody will say, "Have you written this down?"
Is that because we've become, as a culture, we've become children of the book? So when according to Ong, I'm doubtless very badly paraphrasing this, but as soon as you start writing something down, the language, the words themselves become objects.
Yes, and also the way you write with your hand produces a different book from the way you write on the computer.
Really?
Yes.
Explain. Because you can write on a computer faster?
Much, much faster. My first book, China by Rail, is completely different from all my other books. I had to type it out with a carbon paper.
Mm-hmm.
And when I made a mistake, I had to actually cut that piece out.
Oh.
Type another bit, stick it back in again, photocopy it, carbon it. All that kind of thing. It was a completely different situation. So when the Bible is written, when the Torah is written down, and we've copied the Torah for the Hebrew, the Torah has to be written perfectly.
Wow.
One mistake on the last page and that's rubbish.
Really? You have to start again?
Yeah.
Oh, hideous. Whoa.
So... But you can do that in two ways. On the one hand, it's utter perfection, which is wonderful. But the other hand, it's cruel.
Yeah.
So I think the idea of writing stuff down was basically to get the warp down that you could work the weft into it. But the trouble is, we got tied up in the warp and didn't go for the weft. Mm. Or was it the other way around? Again, I've said this many times, all these things just meant to be prompts, foundations.
Mm.
But when you lose the contact with spirit, you turn to the law. You focus on the law.
Intriguingly, the exact same things happened in music. When music was written down, themes were written down upon which variations were supposed to be made in the performance. Now they're set in stone, yeah. Now you write every note, you dictate every variation in tone, in pitch, in, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, obviously it's open to a small amount of interpretation, but if you go back to the times of plain song and stuff like that, it was what was written down and what an audience might have heard in the moment. I don't know if that's actually true of plain song, but certainly for orchestral pieces, would have been completely different. The composer was just giving you an idea. Yeah, playing with it.
Which is why sometimes when somebody does a different version of a song you know really well, it's hugely offensive and terrible. And sometimes it's just...
Yeah.
It's like Disturbed's version of The Sound of Silence. Have you ever heard that?
No.
It's a band called Disturbed. I think they're Australian. I don't know if they've ever done anything else that ever hit a chart or something. But I accidentally heard their version of it. And I listened to this on the radio, just driving. I had to stop the car.
Wow.
And I thought, that's the voice of God.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's really dark. It's incredible, and the video on YouTube is just the lead singer's face, a bit like the Sinead O'Connor "Nothing Compares with You." It's just his face,
which is an incredible song,
which
as
looks
well.
Utterly amazingly and fierce. And you hear the words of that song at the depth I'd never heard them before, and the people bowed and prayed to the neon god they've made.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the sign blasted out its warning. You know, and it really is this song that is huge.
Yeah, I love it as a song. I have never heard. What are they called? Disturbed.
I'll play it to you after this.
Okay, thank you.
If I may.
You may. That could be most interesting.
But then another time, because we're locked in the stone of that's the way that music should be, we don't like it. I mean, my dear mother, who is my greatest spiritual teacher without doubt, would never listen to women singing songs by people like Handel or something, because they didn't sing them originally. It was always choir boys. They didn't have any sopranos. So she still thinks they shouldn't have. But then she was very much a child of the patriarchal society.
Mm.
You know, whereas I didn't have the slightest problem with sopranos. So that's the difference between writing it down, getting it set in stone, so that the next generation thinks it can only be that way.
Yeah, which reminds me then of, I adore that story where you're in church and you're inviting them to speak and you ask the question, do you think God stopped talking 2,000 years ago? Yeah. I just think that's one of the best things anyone's ever said in a church ever.
Thank you. But it doesn't make any sense that God would allow us to write it down and then go away.
Of course it doesn't.
No. That's how it is. You can't do this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. But some people are very happy with it set in stone and that's absolutely fine, but they always cut themselves off from the rest of reality. Back to that story about heaven where the Catholics are ordinary yes. off area because
they're the only ones here.
But just imagine how difficult it is to die when you're that rigid as well, but that rigid, you know, and you're invited to go through to a place where all beings are equal and all there's no religion, it's all love, it's all the lights and something like that. And this book, Testimony of Light, which I recommend. I never have a copy of it because I'm always giving it away. But now I've got it on Kindle. That's mine. But it talks about the layers of heaven and the work, and it's the most extraordinary book. And it was just was given to me after Henry died by a guy who was a nucleus biologist, I think, or the kind of nuclear biologist. But
no, those are definitely
definitely not. But about how people often when they die cannot handle the fact that they weren't right.
Wow. That must be a troublesome moment indeed.
Yes, and it can take some time to recover from it. And you can't progress in the heavens because there are layers and levels and levels and levels and levels and halls and places to learn more and how to help. It's going to be extraordinary up there. Absolutely extraordinary up there. But so many people have to go to the hospital areas. There actually are sort of hospital areas for your faith. And you can't get through until you've actually realised that these nursing sisters are looking after you if you were a Catholic, are trying to tell you that actually it's bigger than that.
Yeah. 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 It's funny, there's a little back part of my mind as ever. Because for me, you're describing the upper world where, of course, there are so many layers. And I'd love to know, and one day I will go and ask the spirits because I sincerely doubt you can answer me. But is it the truth or is it just me where I am so completely resistant to the idea that because things are in layers means that there are levels in a hierarchical sense?
Oh, yes. Such a difficult one, isn't it?
Yeah. And I find that very difficult with the with the whole idea of the patterny map thing that you have that's got ten what's that thing called?
Sephiroth.
Sephiroth. And the idea that there's some kind of ascension. I'm so resistant to the idea, to the very concept, because it doesn't exist anywhere else. So why would it exist there? Yeah. You know, there's not that kind of hierarchy in nature.
No, I don't think there's that kind of hierarchy in spirit either. But there are roles. And there are, from what I get from this book is a channel book from a former Catholic nun who died. And she's talking about all these things. And she does make it clear that you do move on and you become more light. She doesn't say that it's superior, but she knows she can't bear it yet.
Well, yeah. But
can you see that there's sort of a difference there?
Yeah, absolutely.
And as they move up, and we do become wiser as we become older souls. But as we become wiser, we become more love. So we don't regard it as a hierarchy.
No. Well, and so also,
I might, if I died tomorrow and was in heaven and saw incredible, powerful, bright human souls that were clearly way beyond me, I might see it as a hierarchy.
And yet, if lockdown, COVID and coronavirus has shown us anything, has it not shown us that the humble bin person might have more value and relevance in our life than the chairman of BP?
Yeah, but you're still judging it on value.
Yeah.
Even so, yes, you're right. We do put all these hierarchies and these values on people. And yes, it should have shown us that. And in some places it has. But it's also created huge swathes of litter.
Yeah. But whereas in my version of the upper world, or indeed spirit in general, the idea that either one of those people would have more value than the other is just not relevant. You know, they are both the divine. They are both love. They are both here to learn.
Yes, I don't think it's about value, but it's against this language thing.
Mm.
I'm not the same now as I was when I was six. I'm probably a little more. I'm a lot less spontaneous. I'm probably a lot less happy. A lot less. Well, actually, by the time I was six, I think I was pretty repressed. But at the age of coming up to, God, it's going to be 65 soon.
Whoa. Wearing well, though.
I probably, maybe, able to be of more service.
Yes.
It doesn't mean that I'm better.
No.
But it's where I am now to be valued. It doesn't mean to say I denigrate where I was when I was six. And if I found myself as a six-year-old, I can't tell you how quickly I'd scoop her up and tell her how wonderful and marvellous and what could I learn from her, and wow, you know, this is a, oh God, to pick me up, I would love to.
When I was one, I was just begun.
When I was two, I was nearly new.
When I was three, I was hardly me.
When I was four, I was a little bit more.
When I was five, I was barely alive.
But now I am six.
I'm as clever as clever.
And I think I'll stay six forever and ever.
I love that line.
A.A. Milne. Yes, yes. So I don't think it's, I think you move, and you don't see that as hierarchy or value, but the people who have not yet moved might see it as that. Because I think as you move, you drop the hierarchy, the idea of hierarchy. And I am absolutely wired, incapable of not being a monarchist. I like the royal family.
Okay, this is an intriguing swerve in the conversation.
No, it isn't actually. It's basically about the fact that because of my wiring and because of the blocks in my childhood and what I learnt in my childhood, this in my psyche currently is set in stone, and I haven't done anything to unset it because I think it's quite a useful tool to talk to people about, because the majority of people in this line of work aren't monarchists and dislike hierarchy very thoroughly. And an awful lot of that comes from hatred of wealth, hatred of other people having wealth.
Blimey. Okay. So, first of all,
what's that got to do with anything?
No, what it's got to do. I sort of see what it's got to do with what we're speaking about. But how are you hardwired to be a monarchist? And
I don't know.
And I guess, what's it got to do with anything?
Well, it's just that I don't believe that wealthy people are necessarily bad people.
Yeah, no shit.
But lots of people do.
Oh, okay.
But I haven't got that wiring. I can't. So I will say, I don't mind how much money the Queen might have, or all of them. I don't think it would go to anything better, because if we didn't have the monarchy, I think it would go into a presidency, and I think it would go into other things. And I don't mind, because I've got enough.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, I mean.
And when you haven't got enough, or you haven't got the concept that you've got enough, you've got to play this game of the hierarchy, and the hierarchy being wrong.
Which puts you immediately in a world where there is a limitation rather than an endless, wonderful, fecund abundance.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. The full-bloomed rose is not better than the initial shoot.
No.
But don't we love it? And we admire it much more than the administrative because of us.
Mm-hmm.
Not because of it. Not because it thinks it's better.
But also, to me, the idea that, I mean, there's a whole nother conversation, again, where we could talk about the absolutely sickening way in which the very, very rich could sort out the problems of those who do not have enough, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But just going back to the idea of there always being enough and that the abundance of enough is that, on the one hand, there are lots and lots of people who don't have enough.
There are.
And it's not bloody fair. And it'd be pretty easy from that place to look at the likes of Steve Jobs or the Queen or any of the rest of them and go, you know, I can't come anything up with anything more articulate than what the fuck?
Yes. Oh, but I absolutely get that.
Yeah.
But the problem is that they learned lack.
That's a small aspect of one of the problems.
Well, do you know, I don't know that it is a small aspect. I think it's we're on 35 minutes and starting a really serious debate, but let's go with it. Because I was broke for so long, and I healed myself through teaching prosperity consciousness, which of course is what I needed to teach myself. You teach what you most need to learn. I just found out that it is about what you believe about yourself. Worth. It's all about worth. If you don't believe you are enough, you'll never have enough. Because you will create consciousness of that.
On the one hand, I hear what you're saying, and I don't mean to be rude to you, but also that is a very particularly white middle class
thing to
be able to say.
Yes, I agree.
And that, you know, even in this country, never mind taking it to Africa or wherever, you know, that people aren't choosing to starve because they don't believe in abundance.
No, but I'm going to really hit you with this now. They're happier than us.
Yeah.
Even if they're starving to death,
potentially, maybe.
They are happier than us. So they... The terminology, I don't want anybody to have to starve to death.
No.
But if I had a choice between being Kim Kardashian and somebody living in an African village and dying young, I think I'd rather be in the African village.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, well, presumably. I mean, that maybe this is only our ignorance speaking.
And it may again be assuming
that they are probably certainly live a more simple and accepting life rather than life of torment, riddled by self-judgment, etc.
Yeah. Yeah, and the need to have Botox and surgery and all that kind of thing. So, yes, I
also do feel we're skating on such thin ice.
And it's a huge conversation.
Yeah, because, it is a huge conversation. Yeah. And, certainly I wouldn't dare pretend that I know what goes on in the mind of somebody, anyone in Africa, never mind someone who's...
Well, what I will add to this, though, is somebody once said to me, and I thought, God, that's possibly true, is that if you distributed all the wealth in the world completely equally, in 10 years' time, it would be exactly back where it is now.
Yeah, I have heard that theory. And apparently there's a very, very good book about it, but I don't remember what it's called.
No.
A very good book about it.
So it's actually it's much, much deeper than the money. It's never about the money.
Is. It's not about the money.
It's all about everything that we have about disconnect.
Yeah, and particularly in the West, we have been sold this idea that competition is healthy, that winning is important, that because there is fundamentally a lack, if I have two, you can't have one.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you go, for example, to the Bushmen of the Kalahari, if I have two, I could never be happy unless you also have
exactly.
one.
Exactly.
I could never be happy knowing that you lacked.
Yeah.
Especially that you lacked what I had.
Yeah.
And that there's no such thing as competition.
No, and they would not assume that they were superior because they had two.
No. Well, they just wouldn't have two because...
No, they'd give it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, fundamentally, one of the massive things that's wrong, in inverted commas, with... the whole basis of our culture is the idea of personal property.
Yes.
And that personal property is part of where lack comes from.
Absolutely.
And that's
back to the fences, isn't it? My field, your
exactly.
field.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And rather than the idea that everything is a gift from the gods.
Yes.
And it is that every last one of us is child of Mother Earth,
yeah,
divine being, beautiful, beautiful, equally loved child or grandchild,
yeah,
of the grace and generosity of the goddess herself, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that, yeah. So to go back round to last year or something when we started this conversation, that to me, that's the thing, the terrible thing that happened when it all got written down.
Yes, I agree with you. I really do. That's why I study Kabbalah, because it is the oral tradition within this writing. So I can go into it and say, look, that bit's set in stone, but can we look at the message here? Let's look at the metaphysics. Let's look at this. Let's look at that. And what is so revelationary to me is that the greatest messages that I've found in the Hebrew Testament come through the stories of the women.
Yeah. Where I feel sure we should shut up, because I swear you said we should be quiet like 10 minutes ago.
40 minutes. Yeah.
Okay.
Good.
Bye. Thanks for listening.
Bye. See you next week.